Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Into the Darkness. Here you can richly paint in the outer limits of your voice, where dark ink becomes an odyssey of the imagination told in crashing waves of turmoil as emotions are awakened and set to canvas in haunting fashion. I am Pam Ray. With me I have two co-hosts and a special guest, who I asked at the last minute to join us and was gladly did. I have Intimidus Rex, Victoria Frost, and Jeremy. What is Jeremy's last? What is Jeremy's name? Something like that. I don't know. Jeremy. That's his name, yes. And we are all poets on a website called All Poetry with a group of poets called Late Night Poets. You don't have to belong to the group or the website to call in, to share, to listen and enjoy, but it is highly recommended. Now, tonight, is our Dark Poetry Night. It is also a seriality series that we do where we cover the topic of serial killers. So it's going to be much darker than usual. We have less rights than we do on most shows because we do a lot more discussing of the poetry and of the topic itself. And so with that being said, if you find that this show is not your cup of tea, please make sure to check out our other shows. We have 1 to 2 shows per night on a variety of styles of topics and poetry, something to suit everybody's taste. Also, make sure to check out the poetry anthologies put out by Late Night Poets, because when you purchase those, you not only get amazing poetry, you help support these radio shows. And let me say hello one at a time. Hello, Rex. How's it going?
Hello, hello.
Awesome sauce. All right, good to hear you. And hello, Victoria. How's it going?
It's good. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. It's good to hear you. It's very good to hear you.
It's good to be here.
So, yeah. I'm always excited about our seriality shows.
It's kind of one of those fun topics where everybody's always talking about true crime. There's a billion podcasts about true crime, but I sometimes feel like this lets us delve a little deeper into the mind. So a little darker, but a little bit more fun.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And of course, hello, Jeremy. How's it going?
Good evening, everybody. I have so many questions before we even start. How is everybody, first of all?
Good. How are you?
Good. I'm excited for the show tonight. What was the deal the other day? You guys did like a midday show. What was the scoop with that?
Okay, well, what it is the Brevity Writers, yes, the group Brevity Writers, the owner of that group, approached Phil and said, hey, let's get together. You know, so it's a show it's a brevity show for Brevity Writers, but it's done with the LNP studio, you know, so it's kind of like a joint effort thing. And it's a brevity show. It's they usually have a specific topic, and usually most poems are supposed to be like 100 words or less. And it's really interesting, actually. I like it. You know, I will shamelessly promote it because since you asked, I think to me it's really interesting to be able to find something to discuss in a brevity.
Yeah, that can be tough. It can be tough to really dig into it, especially if you're doing it. Spending a lot of time to really digest, you know.
Yep, exactly.
Because on more classic forms or even a longer form poem, you can at least pick out something easily, in my opinion. You can pick out something easily and quickly to discuss and focus on, but a brevity, wow. Cool idea, though. I'm glad that we're getting diversity in our shows. I'm glad that we're getting diversity in the time slots, too. Hopefully it reaches people that can't normally make the times that these evening shows hit.
Exactly. It is nice to have a variety in time slots, absolutely. Absolutely.
Very cool.
But yeah. And so I planned it, and I know this is a silly thing, and I'm sure some people are going to be throwing holy water at me or something. I don't know what. But I planned it so that the dark contest would land on my 666th contest.
Ooh.
Which is what these rights are from. And so I talked to Victoria and I talked to Rex, and it was like, okay, what are we going to do? We were tossed back different ideas, and it's like, well, we could do a seriality show. And I think it was Victoria said, you know, we could do people who claim to be possessed by devils or demons when they killed. And there is quite a few of them out there, actually, throughout history. But I decided to focus on two of them. And that is Michael Taylor and Arnie Cheyenne Johnson. And, of course, you might recognize both those names, especially Arnie Cheyenne Johnson, simply because he was made into one. His story was made into a recent like horror film. Help me out here. What film was it?
Oh, it was, oh, good Lord. It's one of the, not the Insidious series.
Yeah, it was a different series.
I know what it is.
Yeah.
Hold on, I'm going to Google it. I know what it is. It's by Blumhouse.
You know, the funny thing is I have so many pages bookmarked on my favorites, and I'm looking at the one that does not have that. Oh, The Conjuring. It was like The Conjuring 2 or The Conjuring 3. Yes.
Yes, The Devil Made Me Do It, The Conjuring. Yes, there we go.
Yep. Exactly. I'm definitely looking forward to delving into tonight's poetry and, of course, you know, hanging out and discussing it with cool poets and all that fun stuff. So let's go ahead, if you're ready, Rex, and get this ball rolling.
All right. There you go, The Legion, The Possession of Michael Taylor by Selena. And you've got a SoundCloud for that.
Yes, we do. And the SoundCloud reading, this was done by,
Arcana.
Why am I blanking? Yes, Arcana. Yes. Thank you, Jax. All right. And so, here we go.
Garbled voices speak to me in tongues unknown, yet familiar, leading me down the path of malevolent musings and misdeeds. So seductive to my mind, they fill me with a strange fascination, invoking a devilish desire to taste tempting Tartarian torture. I serve those who seek to destroy malfeasance against the Master, from hypocrites camouflaged by pitiful, pretentious piety. They revile me, yet they are the ones binding and scourging my skin. To cast out demons that dwell within, through fear of exposure, of their systematic brainwashing, disinclined to relinquish power, cursing them in incomprehensible words, serpents writhing within, splattering them with venomous sputum, straining at my tethers. I want to scrape off their fascinerous flesh to reveal their mendacity. Sweat-soaked, sapped and serene, they may have won this battle, but not the war. Free! I can unleash the trifecta. Insanity! Wrath! Murder! A caged beast features, disguised and distorted, stare from the mirror. One thought is in my head, screaming over and over, do it, do it. Flexing myself, bones creaking, unassailable in my quest, I reach for her. tearing flesh from bone until the bloody mass that used to be my wife slumps before me. Then I hear an agonized howl and realize it is me.
What a, oh my goodness, what a great way to start the show. That is just a wonderful choice to have Arcana record that for you, Stella. And just a friendly reminder, everyone, if you're unable to call in, the next best thing is to make a recording, because then we get to hear your poem in your voice. I have to say, this one definitely impressed me with the first-person narrative. She wrote, was inspired by the case of the case of Michael Taylor, and you know, just you could tell she really either already knew the case or she researched it, and that impressed me. And of course, I'll be making a further comment, but I do want to hear from others. So, Rex, let's start with your thoughts.
All right. There's a deep illusionary angle that walks within this. Their garbled voices speak to me in tongues unknown, yet familiar. There's that almost ancient draw of the speaking in tongues attitude of being bedeviled or having demons possessed. Then that second stanza, they revile me, yet they are the ones binding and scourging my stout demons that dwell within through fear of exposure, their systematic brainwashing, disinclined to relinquish power. There's a nice touch right there. There's the brainwashing, that which comes with that deep-seated thought of something taking over one's mind, one's body, one's thoughts. It becomes a noted tendency to walk within that world once you've given up to the thought that, hey, yes, they're there, so they must be part of me, and whatever their need, whatever their pleasure, I kind of walk in that sound. I did like the thought of the fascinorous flesh and the mendacity, the lies and the infamous. That was a nice turn of a phrase. And also the second line in that last stanza, I can unleash the trifecta, insanity, wrath, and murder. That was a nice thought going back with inside of how one can actually look in the mirror and uncomplicate matters by saying it's okay to let this come out. And then the thought of do it, and going into that that angle of reducing oneself to a almost robotic notion in the moment of dismembering or bludgeoning something to that which comes out as a bloody mass. And then that thought, I hear an agonized howl, realization of course that the howl is his. And it's not so much a howl of distress. It's almost like a howl of pleasure in the moment of being almost godlike in that in the interim of the act itself. This was tastefully done. I did like the Tartarian torture angle as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I like how you mentioned the idea of the howl being a howl of pleasure, of having that godlike ability. I also really like that you touched on the part where it says about the systematic brainwash, you know, to cast her demons that dwell within through fear of exposure, cursing them in incomprehensible words, serpentine writhing. You know, I can't find it exactly. You know, but you touched on a part where it made me think about, well, part of the interest with the Michael Taylor trial was the fact that there were those who blamed the church that he got involved with for their manipulation. And so the one party that you mentioned with the idea of being manipulated, it has a duality to it. The manipulation that could come from the demons themselves, but it also touches on to me on the idea of the manipulation that came perhaps from outside sources, like, you know, the church he was involved in, or, you know, the religion he was involved in, or, you know, it's just a, you know, something that has been written about and discussed. And of course, you know, I should give a warning that yes, we may be discussing religion a little bit, but we will not be discussing in such a way that obviously I don't think any of us are going to, you know, be argumentative or anything. We're just going to discuss the, you really, honestly, you cannot have a show with cases about people who were possessed by demons without bringing up religion. It just can't be done. So, but yeah, I really like that. And that was a really in-depth observation there, Rex. So thank you for that. Good, great way to start the show. And Jeremy, your thoughts.
Speaking of religion, I feel like I need to go to church after listening to that recitation. I mean, that was wonderfully. I mean, that was wonderfully performed. That was quite a treat. I really commend the collab on that. I think Rex touched on a lot of the pieces and a lot of the lines that really struck a chord with me. I like the fact that you have a predator in this, and when you bring in intelligence to it, it adds a whole other layer of fear, because it's a predator, obviously, that's going to do physical torture, and you feel like you're going to be dominated that way. But then when that line, I can't get over it, the facinerous flesh to reveal their mendacity, when you think that you're dealing with someone that's also probably more intelligent than you, it's really a very scary to think that that's going to be that kind of apex predator. Long time ago, I was in Las Vegas and I saw a movie, and at the end of the movie, Diane Keaton begs for the man she just slept with to stab her, and she goes, "Do it, do it." And
For Mr. Goodbar?
And I didn't know it, buddy. I didn't know the movie for a good 20 years. And someone mentioned the movie, and then I watched it, and I realized it because I only had remembered that very last scene. And then I saw the whole movie and enjoyed it. But that one line in this, that surrender of the prey, or in this case, it's the inner voice of the demon saying for the aggressor to do it. But it just reminds me, it's that surrender of doing something horrific and that repetition of just do it, do it. I know there's no correlation. I don't feel like there's any correlation, but the one did remind me of the other. So, Selena, I don't think that was your intention, but the mood of it was very reminiscent for me. It was wonderfully put together and definitely, definitely a treat for tonight's subject matter.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, that is true, because it does – there are certain, like, movies that, you know, like, it makes you think of. I've never seen that movie, but it sounds like an extremely just intense scene. And so great comment there, Jeremy. And Victoria, your thoughts.
So I want to first start off not necessarily on this poem, but as a sidebar regarding the two cases that we're looking at today. There's a lot of people who, like you've mentioned, have claimed to be possessed when they have performed horrendous. But one thing that I think we're going to get into in this show and that needs to be noted about these cases is that there's some fairly definitive motive behind Michael Taylor. He was getting really close with the pastor of the church. He was spending a lot of time with her. There was thoughts that there was an affair or a desire to have an affair, and his marriage got in the way. Whereas with Arnie Johnson, police actually came out at his trial and said that they actually did believe that there was demon possession involved. The sister to the brothers that they did the exorcism on in which Arnie went and said, take me, give up this child, take me. She actually married him after he got out of jail. There was not a lot of motive that they could find with the landlord, and even he was wandering in a daze. And Michael Taylor didn't necessarily display the same thing. So personal opinion is that after having listened to these cases, before I ever even saw the movie, I've listened to many, many true crime podcasts and a lot of research on these two, because to me this is quite fascinating. Is it psychosis that directs these people? Is it convenience, or is there something else going on here? My personal opinion is that given the testimony, given that the police that arrested Arnie and everything, everybody fought for him to actually get a plea as possession. His was the very first case in the United States to argue it, and it was almost successful. So my personal opinion, I do think that Arnie's was demon possession. Michael Taylor, I'm not convinced. That being said, what I love about this poem and what I love about this topic is that it really doesn't matter what public opinion is. What these people are claiming is a very personal thing. And how do you prove that you're possessed by a devil or a demon causing you to murder someone? What I love about this is that it gets in the mind of someone who very well could have been possessed. Personal pain, I don't think Michael Taylor was. Poem feels like someone who is, someone who's lost in the moment, someone who has these voices telling them what to do, who's taking them away from reality. My cat just scared the shit out of me because she opened my door and I didn't see her, and we're talking about a very dark topic. Whew, excuse me. But this poem is great because it gets into, well, she's a black cat too, so it's like, good Lord, Jesus. But it's a great poem because it gets into that headspace. It's a very personal thing. It's not saying what actually happened. It is this building madness that brings you through the poem, that brings you to that moment until finally he's brought back into reality, hearing that scream only to realize that it is him who is howling, that agonizing howl. It has that slow build, which is how you would expect a demon possession to happen. It's not overnight. It's something that slowly wears away at you until they gain full control and make you do these horrendous things. And so I think this is a really effective poem in that respect. Now, again, I personally don't think that Michael Taylor actually ever was possessed. I think there were other motivating factors, but for a poem to get into that headspace, I think that she did a really, really great job, and that performance was astounding.
I like that. I liked hearing your perspective on both cases. And yeah, you're right. Getting into the headspace was a perfect way to describe what she does here. And I also will say that on a technical level, this has some wonderful alliteration to it, with nice soft sounds. I like the first person narrative. I like the headspace. Now, I will say that I am not convinced either way. I think it's honestly possible that both of them were, possessed. But it's also possible that both of them were not, or, So I'm trying to keep an open mind. Now, with the Michael Taylor I feel like the fact that they performed an exorcism on him leads me to believe that there was demonic possession. But, of course, that's not a 100% thing. That's just kind of how I think and feel at this moment. But I think with the rest of the show, we're definitely going to have a lot of great discussion. So excellent comments, everybody. And wonderful right here. And Rex, what do you got for us next?
You got The Possession of Michael Taylor by S. Sharp. You got a sound file for that too.
All right. Coolio. All right. Here we go.
The possession of Michael Taylor. Empty fields of cotton and coal, Osset, Yorkshire, a man possessed, a church disgraced, a story to be told. Unemployed and injured, bad back, depressed, Michael Taylor attends a prayer group at the Christian Fellowship Church. A young woman, Mary Robinson, rumored to have the power to heal, begins to shake and tremble, the Holy Spirit within her, God traveling through her. She believes God wants her to heal Michael Taylor, free him from the malevolent spirits. But Mavis Smith, also there, begins to weep uncontrollably, distressed. Mary Torn helps Mavis first, kneels speaking tongues to exorcise Mavis of her ills, release the evil from within her. She wrestles not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Shocking the congregation, Michael Taylor joins with Mary on his knees, speaking tongues and praying fervently. Obsessed with Mary Robinson, some would say, making crosses over each other's heads for a number of days, full moon rising for evil to be stayed. His wife upset, so dismayed, in front of the congregation, his fidelity is slayed. Accusations sets Michael on the path to his eventual rage that starts as he assaults Mary in tongues. Despite this display of unrestrained rage, Michael returns to the church the very next day and receives forgiveness. Yet some felt that Taylor's behavior had gone too far, believed that the only explanation was demonic possession. God's servants called for the exorcism of Michael Taylor's soul at midnight on Saturday, the 5th of October, 1974. The purge of evil began, 7 hours of living hell. Taylor's angry eyes shuddered hope, spitting, screaming, biting, and scratching, tied up to prevent him from attacking the two priests. He convulsed, waterboarded in holy water, crucifixes like magnets upon the steel of his soul, 40 demons to be ripped from hell's grasp, evil moles, demons, incest, bestiality, heresy, lewdness, carnal knowledge, and blasphemy had to be dragged by their wings from Michael Taylor's body. By daybreak, the sun rose nervously in the eastern sky. The exorcism failed to cleanse all evil present. Despite this failure, Michael was sent home. The exorcism, like a soap opera, would continue the following night. Before he left the church, the two exorcists warned Taylor that three demons still stubbornly occupied his soul: insanity, anger, and murder. Within a couple hours, his wife and dog were slaughtered. It is the blood of Satan, a man, Taylor, wanders the streets naked on a cold October morning, reported to be covered in red paint, says it is the blood of Satan. Scene of depravity back at the home. Christine Taylor and her dog lay dead and alone. Evil spirits, devil extol, plucked her eyes from within her skull, removed her tongue with a gruesome pull, face lifted, the mask of the devil removed, her evil doll. Dog strangled, eyes torn out, legs removed from their sockets, left no doubt. Its tongue also ripped from its skull. None of them speak in tongues now. Life, religion, evil, taking its toll. The courts would have to decide, was it cold-blooded murder, insanity, evil possession? Taylor's lawyers proclaimed, let those who are truly responsible for this killing stand up. We submit that Taylor is a mere cipher. The real guilt lies elsewhere. Religion is the key. Religion was on trial. Taylor was found innocent by reasons of insanity. Let God judge his soul. But who will judge religions?
Absolutely an amazing SoundCloud. Thank you for that, Scott. Very much appreciated. And I just have to say, wow. Attention to detail was fabulous in this, right? And Victoria, I'd love to start with your thoughts.
So another really, really great performance. This kind of has that haunting tone to it, that tale of foreboding. And so unlike Selena's, this one really goes more into the observer. It's someone almost from a pulpit talking about Michael Taylor, that even though he went to church, even though he did all these right things, really his soul was compromised. And so there, it kind of delves into that tale. It goes through the steps. It goes through how he got to where he was. And yet it ends on the thought, not of Taylor being guilty or innocent, but religion. And I really appreciate that, because there are, again, demon possession. How do you prove it? How don't you prove it? But there's definitely times where psychoses can look like things, and there can be an argument that people can be influenced to believe things to the extent that they believe that they are. So he was in a church that was practicing speaking in tongues, which, no judgment. I'm personally not part of a church that does that, but to each their own. But he was part of a church that was practicing tongues. There was a with him and the woman who was the leader of the church, they did a whole ceremony because I think there was like a full moon and they thought that demon possession was going to be more likely. So there's factors that allow for there to be a thought. It opens a door, be it really or fictitiously, to believe that possession is there. And it's part of the whole, I just spaced out their names, the Amityville horror couple, the demonologist and wife, the Lorraine and what is their name? What is their name? Someone said it.
The Warrens.
So part of the question is how much of that really is happening and how much of that is people convincing themselves that something is going to happen, not just with the Warrens, but any haunted house that you go into. And so this also gives the question of, no matter what, if Michael Taylor was possessed or not, his soul is condemned. What he did is horrendous. But is the religion that opened that door also innocent, or should it too be judged? And I really liked that about that. It kind of calls into question not just Michael Taylor, but the circumstances that may have opened the door, possession or not, psychosis or not, how
exactly
could religion be judged?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you brought that up. And I did think that was a powerful part about that, right, is that it focused on the idea, you know, should religion be judged, or, you know, was there a door opened that shouldn't have been opened, or, you know, was he, like you mentioned, the idea of manipulated, how people can be manipulated to believe something. The couple that you brought up, the demonologist, they
the Warrens,
were involved,
yeah.
The Warrens, yeah. They were involved in quite a few cases, and you know, you can't help but wonder about them also. Like, you know, how much do they exaggerate things in order to sell their books? You know, and but you know,
absolutely.
you know, I'm just tossing out possibilities. But, and the young woman who was was Mary Robertson. She was, at the time he met her, she was leading a prayer group. She was only 22 years old. And, Mary Robinson was the woman that he became involved with. We don't know if there is a physical thing, but we do know his wife right in front of the congregation accused him, and he then proceeded to attack the young woman, Mary Robinson. But I like that you brought up, Victoria, how the main focus of this was, you know, what was religion's involvement with his mindset. And I had noticed earlier on the board, Selena had mentioned that there was a possibility that he actually had schizophrenia. And I do know I had read that when an exorcism is performed, they actually require first for the person to go through, like, you know, psychological testing, if possible, because they want to rule that out. But great comment, Victoria. Thank you. And Jeremy, your thoughts?
Yeah, I'd like to formally request that we go ahead and extend this to a four-hour show, because there's no way I'm sleeping tonight. We're only two deep so far. And if a black cat opens my door too, I'm going to go ahead and check out, because I don't even own a cat, but that'll blow me away.
She didn't enter this time.
One thing that Vic said just a second ago that I really totally agree with is, it doesn't really matter. I mean, it's equally terrifying, right? If demons exist and possession exists, or if it doesn't exist, both concepts, both notions are equally frightening. But the fact that if someone does believe in it enough, whether it be Michael Taylor or anybody else involved in this trial or this case or anyone that's around it, anyone that does believe in it enough to be convinced that it did happen, then for all intents and purposes, I mean, it really did. Because the belief in it alone to cause, or at least to be the impetus for such an ugly event, makes it true, in my opinion. I mean, really, belief is, in a lot of ways, 100% of the reality. I mean, reality is all how we perceive it, and I think a lot of that can be interpreted. So I like Vic's comments earlier about saying that thought. In terms of what Scott put together in this poem, it was really well done. I mean, again, we had a great presentation, a great performance of the poem, but historically speaking, in the perspective that is indeed different, there's not a lot of poetic device in this, but I stayed enthralled and paid attention and was really getting into the story and learning about the history because of his manner in which he told it. In the format of the poem and the punchiness and the intensity of description where it needed to be. I mean, I think I'm seeing a lot more movement, more of that kind of movement in a number of people that I follow here on AP. In which they're choosing muses and they're creating series or whatever, in which it does have this more storied format, this more free-form format. And I think there's an art to do it which can definitely engage and keep the reader, especially with a more lengthy poem such as this. And there's a way that you could easily be turned off and it just turns into prose. I don't think that was achieved here. I was very much involved and enthralled with what you did. And he did it with subtle moves as opposed to more conventional, like I said, poetic devices. I think it's just presented in a real succinct way that kept me as a fan throughout the entire story poem. So very well done.
Well, absolutely. I like that you used the word punchy, because I think that there was an absolute – I liked everything you said, but that was so perfect because of the fact that he has some lines that are really – short, like one to two words, you know, hope, tied up, accusations, all these short, punchy in-between lines that kind of just grab your attention, and it's kept throughout. And you're right, belief is a powerful thing. You know, there's a reason people get caught up in cults. There's a reason people, you know, get involved with things that would seem absolutely crazy, because, you know, they just believe it's that power, you know, and it's the power that can be used. You know, it's going to sound cliche, but it can be used for good or it can be used for evil. You know, it just, I guess, depends. But really great comment there, Jeremy. And Rex, I'd like to hear your thoughts now.
I think this is more in the dip to the reality of the situation. It does offer up the thought, a man possessed, the church disgraced, the story to be told. And that's the lead-in, the angle played out. Because right thoughts of that second stanza, unemployed and injured, bad back, depressed. You've already got the lead-in to the possibilities, then the introduction, Christian Fellowship Church, which just adds another little touch to the story. Then we got the introduction of the woman. She's supposed to have the powers to heal, and he believes God is telling her to heal his back, his depression, whatever it is. And that's where everything starts off as the reality of the situation. So you want to play that angle of being possessed. You've already introduced all the right elements. Yes. They're all actually very relatable and can be offered up for what they really are. Hey, a nice, clearly laid out excuse as to the reality of the situation. Speaking of the tongue angles, that the thought with that is where the church went. Where I hear of speaking in tongues, it's actuality, the thought of speaking in a language not known to you and not now or has been used over the past 2,000 or 3,000 years. That's me, that's speaking in tongues. Offering up a dead language, the reality of, if you're going to go the demon angle, that would be something that would come up, speaking in Sumerian or the ancient language of Egypt, right at the beginning of Pharaoh. Languages that nobody knows now, yet one can assume and rectify the possibilities because there is a little tag along afterwards. Now, the thought with spiritual wickedness in the high places, that comes along with the church these days. You look at all the angles of disgrace, the misrepresentations, the indiscretions that have rocked many a church, not just the singularity, all of them, because of their infidelities on one level or another. And then he gets called out for it, maybe rightly so, maybe not. That doesn't really, that just plays into the equation of the act that he actually went on to do in the second place. But the return to the church, and then everybody in the congregation says he has to be possessed. Yet none of them know anything really about possession because it's just for them, it's just a concept, something written within one of the works they tend to deliver themselves unto. Yet they know nothing of it. Or have to deal with it and go through the ritual madness of trying to depossess somebody. But that's another singularity. You see some of those tales with the possession of Emily Rose. That's not a short-term, one-day, seven-hour session, so to speak. You're looking at 4, 5, 6, 7 weeks at times. And it's something that's ritualized again and again and again and again, getting everything and whatever out, besides all the other activities that come along with it. So my thought with this, by the way, Scott's laid it out, it goes with the fact that he took advantage of the story. He took advantage of everything. He wanted to get rid of his wife. He wanted this other woman. And he got away with it to a degree, although he's going to spend a whole lot of time in a place that ain't going to be very nice. It's a hell of a lot better than being behind bars in the jail. At least here, being in a Looney Tunes hatch, he has the possibility of later on down the line convincing his doctors he's all good and maybe getting out. And on that other note, everybody's talked about the Amityville angle. I've been to 112 Ocean Avenue.
I like those thoughts, Rex. I like that you, first of all, that you brought up the possibility that he himself manipulated the people around him, and that is definitely a possibility. One of the things this article I have open says that others would argue that Taylor's subsequent suicide, okay, it says, some may argue that the fact that Taylor left a psychiatric ward, a psychiatric unit 4 years after the murder, a sane man, indicates that he was never possessed by demonic forces. Others would argue that Taylor's subsequent suicide attempts are a sign of a deeply troubled soul. Both sides appear to agree that Michael Taylor was driven to commit this terrible act by outside forces, whether it was demonic possession or the hysterical neurosis of the church, we may never know. And I read that little part there because I felt like that touched on the idea that you were getting out with your comment. And you're right, he did a great job of introducing each one of the people involved with this and setting out that path for the idea that, you know, there was some sort of manipulation going on. Oh, and the other thing that you mentioned that I thought was really great was that you mentioned that they didn't know anything about exorcism. And that is quite true. His exorcism was actually hastily organized, and it was performed for 7 hours, and at the point they let him leave, they claimed that he was still possessed by three demons, which were, of course, insanity, anger, and murder. And 2 hours after they released him, feeling that he was still a danger to himself, whether he was actually possessed or just faking it, or actually insane, 2 hours after that ended, he then went home and slaughtered his wife and dog. So, you know.
Well, and how he did it, too. I mean, it one thing is taking the eyes out, because that shows you don't want that to see, but also to rip the tongue out of both the dog and his wife, and then dislocate and take the legs off the dog. There's a little bit more in-depth angle to that than somebody who is just mad with demons.
Yeah. And that's a good point. And I also think that ripping out the tongue was perhaps a symbolism towards the speaking in tongues. That's, you know, just a thought. But, yeah,
no,
very cool.
I get that. If he ripped out the tongue, it was simply that she had the nerve to accuse him in front of the whole church of infidelity.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I totally get that. Good comments, everybody. All right. And what do you got for us next, Rex?
Bloody Scene in the Courtroom by Men 529. All right, Victoria, give it a go, please.
All right. Give me a second. It's loading. Bloody Scene in the Courtroom by Man 529. Depression, swirling shadows encircling his soul, gazing, staring, dead eyes, transfixed mirror image, shadows watching, waiting, whispering in his ears. He has lost control. He must seek Mary out. Brown amongst the tombstones he walks. Mary, she can heal him. They will speak in tongues. Entering the church, she is there. He attacks her, rage engulfing him, for demons are amongst him, within him. Depression in its grip of darkness eating away at him, like rotten flesh covered in maggots. Church insists on an exorcism. His wife screams he's having an affair. Crucifixes, ritual chanting, demons, all pure evil as they battle good against bad. Come, they send him and his demons home, unfinished. She's there waiting. Tick, tick, tick. The echo, the mantle clock. Possession overtakes him. Seizing her, he cuts out her lying tongue. Struggling, he kills her. Now for her accusing eyes, he plucks them out. Her dogs trying to defend her, it now lies dead. Legs ripped off, no eyes, no tongue. This bloody scene plays out in the courtroom. Possession banded about, blamed, insanity. I ask you, members of the jury, listen to my words. Was this man possessed? I pose this question to all of you. Think carefully. Is he innocent, or did the devil make him do it? If he was possessed, then how come he can lay his hand on this Bible and swear to tell the truth? I rest my case. End poem.
Oh, bravo. Excellent read there, Victoria. And just a wonderful write by Nat. I will say, actually, when we ran this, we came up with this contest, I reached out to Nat. I messaged her because, you know, I know she loves to write, to, you know, do her research, you know, learn about people in history, has an interest in history, and likes to write about this kind of stuff. So I was glad to see she was inspired. So, and Jeremy, I'd like to start with your thoughts.
Yeah, wonderful performance, Vic. You did a great job of reading that one. That was enjoyable to hear you run through. You know what's cool is, yeah, Pam, that's cool. I like the note that you just gave us that you invited Nan because you can tell that she did a research on this. And to get that deep into the subject matter, I mean, as Victoria was reading this one, I was imagining how surreal this whole freaking couple days of events must have played out and how just extremely charged everything that was going on must have felt. And I think that was captured in this poem. I mean, it's just, it's craziness. And then what I really enjoyed was how there is some detail added to this that Nan couldn't have. She took her brain to that perspective. And there were some details in here that she couldn't have known or couldn't have been published. I'm speaking specifically of on the beginning of the fourth. She's there waiting, tick, 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 echoes the mantle clock. I mean, to take a little detail like that and really bring the reader into a moment that no one knows except for those two that were there, makes it that more horrifying, I guess, for Nan also to take the perspective. I mean, she didn't go too deep, but she took her brain into his thoughts quite a bit on this. And it's such a twisted perspective. And it's you feel it. Like, again, when Victoria was reading this, you feel the charges of so many different conflicting, so extreme emotions that it really makes for a fun subject matter. And for a poet to be able to capture that and to have an audience being entertained by it by not putting them off or overly scaring that they're turned off by the subject matter because of disgust. I mean, I'm enthralled by this. And it's very cool. Very well done. Very well composed.
Absolutely. And you're right. The attention to detail was a very important part of this, like the ticking of the mantle clock. You know, I like that she brings up they send him home and his demons home unfinished, you know, and it was very visceral imagery, very gruesome in some parts, but it's supposed to be because of the subject matter. So excellent comment, Jeremy. And Rex, your thoughts?
Kind of bit into some of the thoughts I had too, but goes back to the last one. But she hit on a couple other ones. Church insists on exorcism with wife's being having an affair, crucifixes, ritual chanting, demons all pure evil, like they battle good against bad. Daylight comes, they send on his demons home unfinished. But that kind of hits on the notion of what the friggin' hell were y'all thinking in the first place? If you really believe this, you send him home undone, filled with demons in him. does that make them not part and parcel to the horror that now unfolds within that next stanza? And she does hit on the thought. Seizing her, he cuts out her lying tongue, now for her accusing eyes. And again, no tongue, no eyes, and the legs ripped off the dog. It's a bit too much. I mean, it's not like the dog's actually talking to him. Hey, the dog didn't accuse you of cheating on the wife, did she? And this last one, I like the thought, that last question. If he was possessed, then how come he can lay his hand on the Bible and swear to tell the truth? That is a hell of a killing line for a prosecutor and his dissertation at the towards the end of the trial and to get a conviction. Yes, apparently.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, yeah, I'm glad you brought up that final question. Now, there is the possibility, because I have read that demonic possession can come and go fairly quickly. I'm not saying that's true or not true, just something I read. So it is possible that someone was possessed during the time of the killing. And, again, I'm not saying that for sure he was. A lot of this is pointing towards the idea that it was planned out and faked and manipulated.
Where the hell is he even going? I mean, is he popping into somebody else?
But I like the question. I like the question. But I will say, just to play the devil's advocate, that it is possible for someone to have been possessed, and then by the time they get to their trial and put their hands on the Bible, not be possessed. It's also possible. But I do like that you brought that question up definitely. And you know what it reminded me of? Do you remember the show Matlock with Andy Griffith?
Yeah.
Okay. It reminded me of how Matlock would always seem like he wasn't going to win the case, and then bam, he'd hit them with something. And so, like, yeah, that's not a very dark thought, but that's what it reminded me of, that ending question.
Maybe the prosecutor, that was a great close, but that should have been a question that jury should have embraced, because once you go, if you go into the thought of where it comes with demonology and possession, the one who is possessed, the demon, does not voluntarily. They have to be cast out. Once they're inside, they are part and parcel of who and what you are.
That is a really good point. That is a really good point. But do they, I mean, don't they have the ability to leave voluntarily? I mean, they don't have to stay.
So if I might jump in. Johnson is actually the same kind of thing, where after he murdered the landlord, the demon possession was believed to have ended. So there are cases in demonology where a possession is not permanent and they do leave. Of course, you have biblical references too, like Jesus and the pigs, where he cast the demons into another living creature. And that's where some of the demonology believes this, is that a demon cannot just free flow down the world like we would expect, like a spectral ghost. It has to, in order to remain in this plane, it has to be in a physical body. But that does not necessarily mean that they cannot willingly leave, because we do have cases like Arnie Johnson, which another demon case, demon possession murder case, where the possession ends. And then there are other cases that don't end in murder, that the possession seems to end on its own, not just necessarily requiring an exorcism. And so that also goes into the varying types of demons in demonology, because you have minor demons, just like you have varying degrees of angels with archangels, seraphims, and then, of course, general angels. There's varying degrees, which, again, philosophically lines up, because if the fallen angels were of varying degrees, there'll be varying degrees of demons as well. But anyways, long story short, it appears that demons are able to leave a human body voluntarily, or after their reason for being there is met, it's just a belief that they cannot reside on this plane without a physical body to inhabit. So Michael Taylor, if he was dispossessed, the demon could have left. It just would have had to jump to someone else. Same with Arnie Johnson.
Very cool. Extra information there. Thank you, Victoria. And I appreciate that. And would you like to comment further on this poem by Nan?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, I mean, it was, I appreciated everybody liking my reading, but honestly, I had goosebumps while reading this because there are those really awesome catches to bring you into the moment. You know, the on sacred ground amongst this tombstone, he walks. You feel the rage engulf him. I mean, there's the rotting flesh, all of it is very visceral. It's very textural. It really puts you in the mirror, in the moment. And I really appreciated actually the gaze staring, dead eyes, transfixed mirror image. There's actually a psychological phenomenon that if you stare at your image long enough in the mirror, it will appear to smile at you and become strange. And it's actually where a lot of the beliefs that the mirror is a portal and that your reflection may not actually be just a reflection come from, because there is a psychological component to just staring at yourself in the mirror. It starts to look like a stranger after so long. And it just, there's a disconnect with it. So I appreciate that it starts there because it actually does hit on a psychological component that even I have experienced. If you go and stare at your image long enough, it just gets creepy. But then of course we have that we're put into the space when we feel ourselves walking through the tombstones. And in my mind, it's kind of like that dewy late night walk where the world's kind of quiet, but you're awake and you're alive. And I could kind of feel the roughness of the tombstone. And caveat, my grandpa's a priest. So I did grow up at my grandfather's church that he had actually started, and at the graveyard was right there. And so I remember after church running through the graveyard and the roughness of those stones. So I felt there. I felt in that place. I knew the graveyard well. And yet there's this reminder of depression, which also I really, really enjoyed, because there are some beliefs or some streams of thought that mental illness is not always mental illness, but it could actually be a demon that our society no longer recognizes. And with mental illness on the rise, what does that say about our society with that thought? But I digress. So depression is mentioned twice. We have that mirror image of the stranger, kind of getting that idea that you're not alone, that what you're seeing is not quite you staring back. There's the idea of Mary, Mary, i.e. Bloody Mary, a demon summoned by a mirror. There's the idea of demons being stuck on him, be it through mental illness, through the mirror, through this woman who's supposed to be a religious and sacred woman, the feel of rotting flesh, and that just, of course, gives us all the creepy crawlies, until finally we're brought to silence, to the point that we can hear the ticking of the clock. And I think that's really poignant, because oftentimes you will speak of your spouse. I mean, let's be honest, marriages are not always great, but they're supposed to be your peace. They're supposed to be your home. And so
yep.
He comes into the presence of his wife and there's silence and there's peace, except for the ticking of the clock. And then the demons take over and the rage comes back, and it's gruesome, cutting the tongue out, plucking the eyes out, the dog laying dead after trying to defend her. It's horrifying.
Skin off his face. Yeah, it is. It's absolutely horrifying.
Yeah, and when it's known that often if someone murders someone that they know and that they love, they will often cover their face. So the fact that the face is just cleanly ripped off, what does that say? Is it so dehumanizing because it was the only way to get the wife's image off, or is it something more? It's gets very visceral, very gruesome, something you cannot imagine doing. The level of rage that would be required to do that is terrifying. And then, of course, the final stanza kind of wraps up with the courtroom. And again, how can this man be possessed if he can touch the Bible? The witch trials, they made them say, our Father who art in heaven, the Father's prayer, to prove that they were witches, because if they stuttered or if they stumbled, then they couldn't possibly be of God. So going back to that old world thinking, if they can touch a Bible, if they can be near a cross, if they can be doused in holy water, they must not be possessed. And then, of course, resting the case, because it seems so contradictory. Is he innocent? Did the devil make him do it? Is there even truth in this? And yet, will we ever really know? Because all we can try to understand of demon possession is what we can glean, though we've not ever been able to experience it or truly study it. It was a really well done poem that I think really brought us into the moment and even feels condemning at the end, which I can only imagine sitting there after living through this, the act of then being condemned for something that you may not have intentionally done. It's really well written.
Oh, absolutely. Well,
thanks a freaking lot, Victoria. Thanks a lot. I have a hard enough time looking in the mirror anyway. Now I got to worry about my demon twin from another portal coming out and grabbing me. Great.
All I have to say is make the lights a little dim, stare in the moment for 5 minutes, and come back and tell me to see Jeremy.
There's another angle I want on that. If we believe in the thought of how physics now walks, there is not a singularity, but a multiverse of singularities that walk the same timeline, and anything and everything that can happen in this world can happen in each and every one of those worlds on a singular timeline all the way through. So if there is that point of looking in the mirror and one can cross over between multiverses, so to speak, one might actually find themselves capable and see themselves do this type of act, thereby demonstrably acting upon it within this world if their mind is already bent to begin with.
Said there, Rex. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And it's such a just wonderfully creepy thought. I just love it. I had this book when I was a teenager, and it said that if you lit a candle in front of a mirror, stabbed a knife into an apple, held it over your shoulder, and stared into the mirror, you would see your future husband. And I was very disappointed that I did not see Jason Patrick from The Lost Boys.
Jeremy, are you disappointed?
Great comments, great conversation, and I have to say I was really impressed with this poem, the attention to detail, the visceral imagery, and you brought this up, Victoria. I like that she brings up his psychological problems first, the depression swirling shadows encircling his soul, depression in its grip of darkness, eating away at him like rotten flesh covered in maggots. So she touches not just on the idea of the possession, but the idea that he was already dealing with psychological issues. So just an excellent write by Nan. Very well done. And Rex, what do you have for us next?
The Devil in Your Head by Eminem Fan 25 for Jeremy, please.
Devil in Your Head by Eminem Fan 25. I know you feel me in your head and hear the words I say. I promise I will keep you safe. It will all be okay. I knew you wouldn't let me down. It does no good to run. It's time for you to take a nap. You'll wake when I am done. Your wife is rather beautiful. She clearly loves you so. It sucks that she is in my way. To heaven she must go. I hear your dog outside the door. Its mouth will just not stop. I'm sorry that I left a mess. I couldn't find a mop. It's time you take off all your clothes. Enjoy the England air. I will be gone in just a few, Your crime is truly rare. I thank you for the loads of fun and wish your life goes well. But now it's time that I depart and chill again in hell. End poem.
Read there, Jeremy. And, you know, I really like this one. First of all, I always recommend that people, like, check out all the poets that are featured on our shows. But Eminem Fan 25 is a particularly good rhyming poet. With this one, I like the fact there are some of the different things I really like about this one, besides the great rhyme and meter, is that it was told from the perspective of the demon. It was a first-person narrative from the point of view of a demon. The other thing is I think he pulled off well, is that he added a bit of humor to an extremely dark topic. You know, like, and of course I've got a dark, twisted sense of humor, but, you know, like lines like, I'm sorry, I hear your dog outside the door, its mouth just will not stop. I'm sorry that I left a mess. I couldn't find a mop. And another one that I found particularly amusing was, it's time you take off all your clothes, enjoy the England air. And I've never been to England, but I've read and heard enough about it to know that, you know, they can have quite chilly and wet weather there. So I liked that. I thought that was, you know, a great touch of humor that added a lightness to an otherwise extremely dark topic. You know, I promise now, and on the darker side, what I find extremely darkest part of this is, I promise I will keep you safe. It all will be okay. Your wife is rather beautiful. She clearly loves you so. It sucks that she's in my way. To heaven she must go. Now, first of all, I find it extremely fascinating that he brings up that the demon says to heaven she must go. In other words, you know, the demon is acknowledging that there is heaven and she will go there. But at the same time, you know, he's making it very clear. And I realize demons may be either sex or no sex at all, but I just say he because, well, what can I say? It's just because that's what sounds right. But yeah, like this whole idea of someone being used for something or someone else's evil purpose. You know, I think Eminem Fan did an excellent job with this, right? It was very well done. And Victoria, I'd like to start with your thoughts.
So I agree. There really is kind of this playfulness almost to it, but I'd say it's also a taunting. The idea of, look what I've made you do, and there's nothing you can do to stop me. You know, I do like, you were mentioning how it was talking about his wife going to heaven, because when you think about demons, you wouldn't assume that they would care that anybody goes to heaven. In fact, arguably, they would want to collect as many souls as possible. So the fact that they're allowing or they're creating this circumstance in which they're willing to release one soul, what does that say about their motives and their intentions? And what is the foreboding that it leaves you with to think that they're willing to let one soul go? What does that imply? That potentially more souls they're going to be able to capture by doing that. So maybe that's what they're doing. Maybe, you know, often, and I was raised Christian, and I am Christian, and I remember as a child, my mother always saying, don't open the door. Don't open the door to the devil. And it does make you wonder that if talking about these things is opening a door, then how many doors have been opened by all the people who wrote poems, by all the people who've read these, people who've listened about podcasts? How many people have researched possession and gotten close to possession and followed down places that would allow possession, all because of one man? He let one soul go because maybe this opened far more doors for them to take. Really, really cool piece.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I have to say, that comment sent shivers up and down my spine. That comment was just about as creepy as the right. So, very cool there, Victoria.
Thanks.
And yeah. Dang it.
Jeremy, are you
going to
sleep tonight?
Jeremy,
yeah, you're not even trying to hold back. You're not even trying to hold back anymore, Vic. You're just really trying to screw with me now.
No, I am, you know, and personally, I believe there is such things as demons and angels and, you know, the things beyond our realm, you know. But I do also believe that it can be used as an excuse or overused. I mean, like, when I was in, like, ninth grade, my stepmom decided we needed a little more, bit more, like, spirituality, a little more God in our everyday life. So she had this religious teacher come over, which didn't last very long because the religious teacher said, as most of you all know, I have epilepsy. And the teacher said that the reason I had seizures was because I was possessed by demons. And so that was my one personal experience. I don't dismiss completely the idea that demons do exist. Yeah, I don't. But at the same time, I feel like too oftentimes it's used as an excuse or a reason because we don't want to deal with the fact that, it, you know, medical conditions actually exist. Wow. I don't know. That really doesn't have a whole lot to do with this poem or Victoria's comment, but it did come to mind as you were talking, Victoria. So I thought
I
would share.
I really appreciate that too, because I actually too believe, like you, I believe that there are demons, and I don't know that they're necessarily always the reason things happen. But I have a couple creepy experiences of my own life that have solidified my own beliefs. And so I think that it's actually a really valid comment, because if you think of the idea of, are we opening doors? And if you believe in that, like me and like you, and the possibility of it, then it does beg the question. There's that horrifying level of, have we opened a door that we cannot close? And what does that mean? So I actually really appreciated your comment, Pam.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate yours. And Rex, I'd like to hear your thoughts.
All right. Irony comes to a great point in this. Also loaded with heavily with a sardonic humor, because it does walk on two levels. And that last stanza has me thinking not so much the demon, but there is another entity which is neither good nor bad, yet does walk in that world of creating havoc and having itself a bit of fun in the meantime, a djinn.
I like that. I like
that.
Like that. A neutral, like almost
if you,
like
if
a
you're
god of mischief, like a
to, evil itself. A djinn can help that along the way by having a little fun with it, by pushing you a little further along the line.
I like that thought. Yeah, you know, because. Yeah, because there could be such, you know, like the djinn you mentioned. I like that you brought that up. And you're right. This is definitely filled with sardonic humor. And there is in that end stanza the idea of something mischievous, for lack of a better word for me. But very cool observations there, Rex. And Jeremy, you did a wonderful read of that. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I liked, I totally agree with what Vic said earlier, that it's kind of the taunting nature of this. And Pam, at the very beginning, you said how Eminem does such a great job of doing these rhyming poems. It's not my bag as much, but I can always appreciate when someone does it correctly, and I feel that was done here. And because it's done with because of the subject matter that we're talking about tonight, the fact that it's so sing-songy, and nursery rhymey, for lack of a better word. And it's done with all of that. It's this playful, boastful nature that makes the evilness even more, because it comes across as an untouchable boastfulness and vanity. You know, I'm going to make this playful and fun, because I'm so rotten that I can, and there's nothing that anyone can do about it. I'm enjoying the fact that I am this ugly and this evil and doing these awful things. So doing the perspective and then using that voice with that style of poem is really kind of genius, and it adds just that extra layer of cringe to all of this conversation that we've been having tonight. And doing it from a different way, it's cool. It's cool that everyone's going at it, and not only the perspective, but the formats across the board really kind of shake it up quite a bit. So I was pleased to see that Eminem took it to this level with his style.
Oh, absolutely. You're right. I have to agree. And the like you said, the sing-song style really added to the creepiness, the whole idea that someone could be so evil that they could commit such atrocities and be playful at the same time. Like, it did that definitely add a layer to it. So great comments, everybody. And Rex, what do you have for us next?
Red-Eyed by Chamath Akalanka. I saw two kittens messing around with their bare feet, up and about, the white eyes. They hung a collar by the window. Slow and steady, my heartbeat felt. True perfection of eyes that look past the moral conventions of her day, as a stream flows through the forest, excites me. The uninhibited sense of true monsters, rebellious in their attitudes, with strange conviction, gleams light as a perfect moon, the sun being the essence of all true genius, monsters and saints alike. But the riddle of spilled blood is too hot to handle for the weak human mind. So the possessions of spirit took over the world as this genius began to hit the more mediocre spirit. I guess from the democratization of everything. But the splendid afternoon only ever becomes more glorious with the passage of time. So too, so much like art and poetry, this democratization from had begun to shine a light upon the valleys where no sun was yet to shine. Being the first saints belonging to a long tradition of monsters, these specimens took the popular imagination by storm. The genius of spilled blood, the genius of white kittens amusing themselves, being crushed, or what is forever lost, being recovered. The belt that hung over the curtain rod now strangles the purity out of a white kitten into the pages of poetry and the author. Hey, Paul.
Wonderful read there, Rex. And Chanmith was actually the first one to write to the case of Arnie Chime Johnson. And I think he did a wonderful job with the metaphor and there was just a really wonderful surreal vibe to this write. And Victoria, I know that Arnie Cheyenne Johnson is a case that you know quite a bit about. And so with this poem, I'd like to start with your thoughts.
Yeah. So what I really liked about this. So first about, I want to start with Arnie's story. So much like The Conjuring kind of starts, Arnie was the boyfriend of, and I forget her name, but Arnie was a boyfriend of this girl, and this girl had a brother, and the brother had multiple exorcisms performed on him, and they got to a final exorcism, and it was not going well. I mean, the records from this exorcism are terrifying, and what Arnie did, against everybody's recommendation in the heat of the moment, took the younger brother, and he was a child, like less than 10 child, took the younger brother and pleaded with the demon, because they believe that the demon is going to kill the boy, pleaded with the demon to take him and to release the boy. And after that day, they said the story goes from these, and this is through the Catholic Church, not through a church that speaks in tongues. This was done by priests and priests that were certified for exorcisms. But the records state that after Arnie did that, there was a calm and that they could see the demon go from the boy into Arnie. And after that day, the boy never had any instances again. And Arnie originally believed that he was going to be, they didn't see anything. There was a moment before the murder of the landlord where there was a violence that came out of nowhere. It was uncharacteristic. Arnie did not remember the violence after the fact. And then, of course, there was the murdering of the landlord. So it's quite an interesting case, and there's actually a lot more, from what I've listened to in comparing the two, there's actually a lot more religious documentation of how the possession may have come about and what followed thereafter. So with that being said, and then, of course, the case is quite interesting because the police came out in his defense and everything. So what I really like about this is that it starts really benign. And I won't lie, I saw two kittens messing around with their bare feet up and about, the wide eyes, there hung a collar by the window. Slow and steady, my heartbeat felt. This is kind of misleading because you talk about looking at kittens, white, pure kittens messing around, playing with their bare feet. You kind of get an image of like the sun coming through the window, and it just feels very nonchalant. But as you go on, you start to understand that there's a little bit of darkness behind it. There's this false sense of security. There's this kind of losing oneself. And it actually falls in really well with Arnie's story because he was not aware of the murder. I just spaced his other name. It must be getting late. I'm getting tired. But like Michael Taylor, he too was found wandering down the road covered in blood, completely oblivious. He was barefoot. I mean, he just was completely unaware. And it gives you that idea of being put in a place where you're not really there anymore. And I think about the movie, the best way to explain it, I think about the movie Get Out, where they go into the sunken place. They're there, but they're not. And unlike the sunken place, they're not seeing their body and their life continuing on without them. Instead, he's lost in this world where he's distracted by something benign and cute and pleasant. All the while, this possession has taken over the human mind. It's taken over his spirit. And only after his body has been used as a vessel to pour out atrocious crimes in poetry and paper, only then does he regain himself. There's a genius behind it, because how do you claim possession when you can't even remember? How do you claim it wasn't you when there are witnesses that said it is? How do you prove yourself of these things when the killer can never actually be caught? So I thought that this was actually really quite, to use their word, splendid, because it really does get into the mind of being hidden from your own eyes and being put into such a place where you become so vulnerable that you are much like this white kitten, only your hands are the ones that come out bloody. So I thought this was a really great, great poem, because it doesn't directly talk about it, but it gets you thinking.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the fiance's name was was Debbie Glassell. That was
there
her
you go.
Brother.
Yeah.
Yes, that was possessed. That was a really interesting case. And I did like, to me, when he, brought up the kittens, it served two purposes. One, the murder actually took place at the pet, what do you call that, where animals go?
Yeah, it was a boarding house. They were living in the apartment above a boarding house, basically.
Yeah, but it was, okay, where do you adopt animals from? An animal shelter, that's it.
Yeah.
They, The murder actually took place at the animal shelter, and it almost seems like it was a cut and dry case because of the fact that the drunk landlord was harassing the guy's fiance and another woman, and it was at the animal shelter. And so to me, like, the kittens really served a nice kind of metaphor and a duality of representing both the animals that were around and the women themselves that were offered up as prey. I really like how Victoria, how you brought up the case and talked about the detail, because I think the detail of this case is very important to understanding any poem, but especially one that's written in I must be losing my ability to say words.
It's late. Metaphorical, the more metaphorical.
A more metaphorical
senses.
Way. So, yeah, but
yeah.
You brought up, and there really is the sense of somebody being unaware and then suddenly becoming aware. Excellent comment there. And I tell you, I am such a hand talker. If we were doing, like, this was, like, video chat thing, all you guys would see in my hands waving in front of your faces.
Check out our new YouTube channel, Late Night Poets, Seriality,
yeah,
where
right.
Pam will be speaking with her hands.
Yeah. But great
comment. Hands flailing about almost like you're possessed, Pam. Is that what you're saying?
Jeremy, you're getting in on the fun now.
I wish I knew just enough Latin to scare the fuck out of Jeremy. I almost gonna go
don't worry. Vic has done a great job of making me poop myself tonight. So, and then Rexy would do some other triple dimensional shit in there too. No, I'm done. You guys have already toasted me. I'm good.
Too funny. And speaking of you, Jeremy, let's hear your thoughts on this poem.
Yeah, of course I want to start off by giving a nod to Rex. I always love it when he reads poetry because he does such a great job of it. I think his recitation of this poem was spot on, and I really enjoyed how he got into it. I like earlier comments. This is much more of a metaphorical poem, and I like that. Again, I like it that we're not seeing a lot of repetition in how everyone is taking the prompts tonight. People are taking from different perspectives, and then they're putting their different twists on it. So it was refreshing once again to see someone go at it in a different angle. It was much less literal. It was much more metaphorical. But it had all of the right elements to it. In talking about the white kittens, the repeated themes that go on throughout this whole thing, that was the genius of it because of the contrast. You take something clean, pure, precious, and then you juxtapose it to something much more ugly. And it created such a foreshadowing or foreboding feeling like what Vic said earlier because I was feeling it. I mean, I know that we've been talking about it all night, but from the very beginning, you started with white kittens, and I just went, oh, hell, this is going to get ugly. And I like the fact that you could feel that. You could feel it without even being said. And when it came, the punch was subtle enough to let your imagination take hold and really go with it. I think the constant theme repetition throughout the poem took you in and out. It took you to the highs and lows, the positive and negative, the evil and the holy throughout the poem. So it was a roller coaster ride. And again, I have to point out the fact that that contrast alone of the symbolism of what's good and what's bad is what makes everything so much more poignant, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So cool poem, great conversation, guys, tonight. This was a great addition to the whole theme.
Oh, absolutely. I have to agree with you. Yeah, the repetition and the subtlety used, and I really particularly was drawn to the genius of spilled blood, the genius of white kittens amusing themselves, being crushed, or what is forever lost being recovered. To me, those are really powerful and thought-provoking lines. But, great comment there, Jeremy. And Rex, you did a wonderful read of that. Your thoughts?
Well, I think that opening stanza is the murder itself on a couple levels. The two kittens is the loss of innocence for the murderer and the loss of innocence for the one being murdered. Often about the white eyes, that hits me with the thought of
the eyes rolling back in the head once the oxygen has been taken. The collar by the window, a reference to a priest or someone of the church. Slow and steady, my heartbeat felt. There's no raised level, no fear. There's just a steady beat in the moment. Everything else from there hits on that notion, the same thing. True perfection of the eyes that look past moral conventions. As a stream flows through the forest, that excites me. The forest, the body, and the mind itself. The thought of true genius, monsters, and things alike. So there's a part that understands the note of a monster, but this one here, but the riddle of spilled blood is too hot to handle for the weak human weak mind. So the possessions of a spirit took over the world as this genius began to hit the more mediocre spirit. I guess from the democratization of everything. I won't go with the spirit, but I will go with the angle of multiple personality disorder, where you have one person who does the evil deeds that need to be done out there as a protective note to the singularity, while keeping that singularity safe from the deeds that have been done, thereby keeping some semblance of innocence, but still offering up the note that there is no innocence because it is done by your hands anyway, even though you carry two entities, not a singularity, but two minds within one body. And let's see. Now, the thought with the long tradition of monsters, it tells me something about happening within the church, especially where it hits up the angle with the saints. So, again, that thought with the collar by the window has me thinking of a deep-seated resentment towards the church itself and the need to maybe wipe that stain off of the innocence that once beheld its nastiness.
Thought there, Rex. You know, and I was, you know, sometimes it's the little details that somebody sees differently that really helps me to, you know, see something. Like, you know, instantly I'm thinking, you know, like a dog collar, you know, because being at a pet, an animal shelter. But when you brought up the idea that it could be the representation of a priest collar, I thought, wow, that, you know, that is really great, and that makes sense. You know, it fits with this theme. The sun began the essence of all true genius, monster and saints alike. And it also, as you were talking, I started thinking about how it's interesting how so many serial killers see themselves as geniuses. And, well, technically not all of them. It's kind of more like that idea of that bloated, narcissistic personality that they have. But really great observations there, Rex. And I also really like that you brought up the idea of the multiple personalities and the idea that there is usually always a personality that is the protector, that does the things that needs to get done. So great observation. And what do you have for us next, Rex?
A Demon's Bagatelle by Jack Blue. That was yours.
Okey-dokey, Smokey. All right. And A Demon's Bagatelle by Jack Blue. And it goes like this. He dared to blame his crime on the malice of my rhyme. Did I make him do the job? I just let him play himself. Asking him so many times about his own malignancy, I kindly helped him perform his own transcendent tragedy, or work his martial marionette as it could shadow everything of its follies programmed punctually and flawlessly. In brief, I simply asked him if he believed in love or grace, how his so-called humanity might really not a bad mirage, or why he kept remembering the feeble flame of fantasy while the clock was eating life in space's bleak infinity. So it was absurdly wrong to blame me for his blasphemy when the devil had in hand made me rhyme against his grace and poem. And I thought this was another great one from the perspective of the demon. Very interesting, very thought-provoking. And Jeremy, I'd like to start with your thoughts.
Didn't we hit on Bagatelle just last week as well? This is the second time I'm getting this word. And did we have another one last week that had that in the title?
Yes, we did.
We did.
Also from Jack.
We've done like a few rights. Yep.
It was also from Jack. Okay. Well, at least I'm learning a little bit here, guys. Slowly but surely, I'm expanding my vocabulary.
Yeah.
No, this is a sweet. I mean, I really. It was sweet in the fact that I don't know that sweet's the right word to describe something so dark, but I like how it was composed, and I like how I'm having a hard time enunciating what I'm trying to say when I use the word sweet. Anyway, I like how it carried its thought, and I like how the perspective works so well, and especially the deadpan very end, because there's subtle rhyme throughout, and the fact that in the end it doesn't rhyme or it doesn't click the way it does in the beginning, in the early part of the poem, made me rhyme with grace, and it showed the distortion of all of it, and I thought that was a really cool move there at the very end. There's also the word grace. He repeats that in the poem, and that's the only word that I caught that he repeated. He catches it in the fourth and he catches it in the fifth, and I like that. And it's funny that that's the fact that grace is what caught me both times, because in brief, I simply asked him if he believed in love or grace. I like how it was put right there. It was put innocently, the question on what the motivation was. And then again, what I said about the deadpan at the end. But I thought it was very interesting that grace was the word that I keyed in so well, and it's kind of hidden, and it's not really highlighted in the fact that there's that repetition. And then in terms of stanza choice, again, the third I liked, because I like that opening innocence of how it asks the question, but then he goes much more ethereal, metaphorical in the description of the rest of the stanza, and it kind of takes a different turn. So I really like that piece as well. Jack, thanks for the education. Thanks for the vocabulary expansion, and obviously, thank you for contributing to tonight's discussion with a very well-composed poem.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and I like that you brought up that, you know, he uses the word grace a couple times. Like, it becomes a focus of this poem. And I totally agree with you that the fact that the first three stanzas rhyme and the last one doesn't really add to the idea of that twist of that, you know, that like that idea of everything falling apart. So great observations there, Jeremy. And Rex, your thoughts.
This kind of bites the sort of indoctrination through inculcation, because the opening stanza hits on the thought of God, while the back end of this walks on the devil. So you walk within that realm where you're constantly being pounded, manipulated into believing this, and this, without being offered the thought to, this is where we go. Now you need to decide how you think on this level instead of having it drilled down into you. There's no thought to a clear-headed determination of self. Because he hits on the thought. Marionettes, programmed, punctually and flawlessly. So-called humanity, as Jeremy mentioned, love of grace. Then there's the feeble flame of fantasy. So when you've got that much walk down into your psyche that is both fantastical and mystical, spiritual. Somewhere down the line, some people break because it's way too much information. It's too much having someone develop their own paranoia within a youthful mind to the point where it goes off the rails. And because you look at that last line, the first stanza, I just let him play himself. That is free will. on the godly realm, so to speak, as on the back end. So it was absurdly wrong to blame me for this blasphemy when the devil, hat in hand, made me rhyme against grace. So that angle here has got to, hey, I'm not guilty of this because the devil made me do it. But actuality is you've been sitting way too much inside the thought of one angle against the other, and you're probably guilty anyway.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I like that you brought up that this does have that feel of almost like, to me, anyways, as you were commenting, I thought, you know, that something you said triggered the idea that this is almost like the idea of a demon presenting his case to God. It very much reminds me of the story, and obviously a well-known story, where Satan in the form of a snake says to Eve, you know, did God really say to you that you cannot eat from that tree? And because it has that manipulation, I simply asked him if he believed in love or grace, how his so-called humanity might really not a bad mirage, or why he kept remembering. That idea of that poking, that prodding, that questioning, that manipulation that makes somebody doubt. So I think you definitely had some wonderful observations there, Rex. Thank you. And Victoria, your thoughts.
So I really liked what you were saying, Heather. It's kind of like that pleading of the demon's case to God. But I'd say that God's not even really involved in this. It starts with he dared to blame his crime on the malice of my rhyme. And as Jeremy kind of mentioned, there's not really a consistent rhyme throughout this. So it's kind of like, what is he blaming? What rhyme is there to blame on? And I think that was intentional. And like Jeremy, I'm kind of failing with my words. But I think it was intentional that there's mention of a rhyme, and then the poem doesn't really have this consistent rhyme scheme. Because it's like the demon saying, he's saying I made him do it, but there was nothing for me to take the blame. Sure, I might have been around, but ultimately, everything he did was on his own accord. And it goes against, it's not really, again, the demon making an argument to God, but more like the demon going before its own jury saying, this is my chance to speak. And you can see it's ludicrousy. But then it even kind of ends with him saying, the only reason I was even here is because the devil made me come and be around him. He made me try and rhyme against this grace. But as you can see, I didn't even do that, because he's the one who was already malignant. He's the one who was really lacking humanity. He's the one who's saying that this is just a bad mirage, and that ultimately it wasn't me trying to hide him somewhere else and take over him and do an evil deed. I just happened to be here because I was required to. Maybe he was supposed to stay with the boy, and because of how things went, he was forced to. But it is the demon, and I do agree with this. It does appear to be the demon's voice saying, I didn't do it, and I'm not holding the smoking gun. Correlation does not equal causation. And so I thought this was kind of fun in that respect, because it feels like a toying. Again, it leaves that what if open. If Arnie is not possessed, was not possessed, then why did he do what he did? And again, it makes us question the atrocity. Arnie was the first case in the American judicial system that claimed the devil made me do it. And they legitimately thought about it. The saying was, you know, the courts already recognized God, so now we ask them to recognize the devil. That was one of the famous or infamous lines from this case. And it was seriously considered. Is demonology, is the devil legitimate if the courts already recognize God? And so here is that demon taking its opportunity to plead his case. Sure, I might be real, but don't blame me on your deeds. So I thought it was fun. It's an interesting perspective on the case, and yet again calls into question, did the devil make him do it, or is it just a opportunistic claim to make when you do horrendous things that seem so inhuman to begin with?
Absolutely.
I think the line angle.
Well, is that right?
I think the rhyme angle might be that age-old question. If you yourself don't believe in God, how do you dare to believe in me and deign me, the master of your criminal activity?
I like that. Yeah, that is a really cool thought there. And, yeah, you have to, like, can you believe in one and not believe in the other, you know? And Victoria, you brought that up, that was actually something that was presented to the court. It's like, if you can believe in God, then, you know, if he's brought into the courtroom, then you need to bring in the idea that demons also exist. This is what Arnie Cheyenne Johnson was, truly a fascinating case. They both were. But, yeah, there were definitely some particular details that were fascinating. And I like, as you said, Victoria, that this leaves you with more questions than answers. Now, obviously, with only about 3 minutes left, I'm not going to try for us to push another poem. So the last two that we had will get moved to after midnight. And we're going to do some real quick shameless promoting. And, of course, I'll close up with my thank yous to everybody. So let's see here. Well, first of all, join us tonight for Fill My Eyes and Company with Open Poetry. Saturday, 12:30 a.m. Eastern U.S. time, join Babbler and me for Part Sinner, Part Saint. I believe Babbler is running a contest. Make sure to check that out. I'm sure she needs rights. I have at least a couple or more contests running that need rights, so please make sure to check those out. Check out all the contests put out by our late night poets, hosts, and hostesses. You're sure to find something to inspire. And Rex, what do you got going on Sunday for Rhythm and Rhyme?
Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Since it's such a nice, surreal piece, I'm sure you can pick out a line or a stanza, mix and match, and have a little bit of fun with it.
Awesome. I like it. Great choice. Oh, and for our next twist, couple other contests I want to mention. Louie Wild Doves is running a Memorial Day quote contest. Very important. Memorial Day, we remember our veterans and the veterans all over the world who sacrificed themselves. So make sure to check that out. Fill My Eyes is running a contest for Twisted Tuesdays called Delightfully Dark. Just got some wonderful dark art there. And I'd like to say, of course, thank you to everyone who wrote for the show, who are listening now or will be listening later. We appreciate you all. Thank you, Rex and Victoria and Jeremy. I appreciate you all so much. This has been a great show. So thank
may
you.
May I cut in real quick?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Black Lace Diaries is going to be returning. So we do have a contest up just based off of the song Control by Puddle of Mud. So be looking on that in the next few weeks. We're going to have Black Lace Diaries returning to After the Art of Seduction on Wednesdays.
Awesome.
Puddle of Mud.
Awesome.
Does that mean that you're going pool dancing in a puddle of mud and t-shirt contest?
No mud wrestling this time, Rex. Sorry to disappoint. But it's their song Control, which fits in really well with the topic of Black Lace, which tends to be a little bit more on the kinky side. So.
Uh-huh.
Nice. Very cool. Very cool. And Jeremy, since everybody else has said something in closing, you got anything you'd like to say?
Yeah, effers, wide awake here, going to be up for the rest of the night. So, whatever.
We are the late night host, Jeremy.
Wonderful show, guys. Thank you as always. Wonderful conversation.
Absolutely. Have a good night, everyone.
Night.
Good night.